Hey everybody, welcome into the back room. I'm Andy Ostroy. I can't begin to tell you how excited I am for today's guest. She is Fresh Air co-host Tanya Mosley. We shall get to her in just a second, but first, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you listening, and we'd love to hear your comments. So email us at backroomandy@gmail.com and or post on our social media, and we'll read some feedback next time. And if you like the podcast, please rate and review and follow or subscribe, and you'll be notified every time we post a new episode. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about Tanya Mosley. She is an Emmy Award-winning journalist and co-host of Fresh Air with Terry Gross and Tanya Mosley. She is also the founder of TMI Productions, which is an audio documentary production company that produces the award-winning podcast Truth Be Told, as well as the brand new documentary She Has a Name, in collaboration with American Public Media. Previously, Tanya was a television correspondent for various news outlets, including NBC and Al Jazeera America. She also served as the LA-based co-host of Here and Now, a midday radio show co-produced by NPR and WBUR. Tanya, welcome into the back room.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to talk with you. I really admire your work and you as a person. I want to get into all of that with you, but I just would first like to peel away the onion a little bit and give our listeners an opportunity to understand not just what you do, but who you are. And look at childhood a little bit and talk about where you came from, family situation, and how that shaped you into the person you became with your career and as an adult.
Mm-hmm. That sounds wonderful. So, I'll try my best.
Yeah. So where did you grow up? And tell me a little bit about your family.
Yeah, so I grew up in Detroit, Michigan in the 80s and 90s. And I no longer live in Detroit, but I'm a third generation Detroiter. So my family moved to Detroit during the Great Migration in the 40s and 50s. To work for the automotive companies. You know, that's a very common story for Detroiters. Most people went there either for music or for cars. And right. My family on both my sides went for both. And so I have a large family. A lot of them have now moved away from Detroit, including myself, but born and raised there. And always had a love for storytelling and always had a love for news. And so I got into that very early in my life.
When was that? When did you first get bitten by the journalism bug?
Well, you know, my grandfather was such a voracious reader and consumer of news. He would get both the papers. You know, this was back in the day when you would get a morning paper and an evening paper. So he would get the Detroit Free Press and then the Detroit News, and he would listen to all of the radio shows, even the ones he disagreed with. So it was very far right leaning, far left leaning. He was just listening to everything. And I was very close to him. I grew up right around the block from my grandparents. So I was always over there and always consuming news. And so very early on, my grandfather would outfit his grandkids with recorders. So I had a tape recorder, and all of my cousins had that too. And he'd also record us a lot. I was the only one who took an interest in it and wanted to do it beyond that. I just found it so fascinating. And so I would interview my family members and record them and just record slices of life in my neighborhood, you know, just fun stuff. I didn't know it was journalism at all or storytelling, really. I was just fascinated by the medium. And as I started to learn about careers, it seemed like writing and storytelling was something that was my calling. And my grandfather, again, got me a Brother word processor one year when I was about 12 years old. And so I would just take the newspaper articles and rewrite them on this processor. And the rest is kind of history.
Wow. So you owe it all to Gramps in a way.
I do. I really do. He was such a supporter and a champion of me.
And, you know, when I was in college, my degree was broadcast journalism. So it's a space I've been interested in my whole life. But I kind of separate people into one of two buckets. Like when you're young and you see an ambulance or a police car speed by, there are those who just keep walking. They don't care. And then there's the rest of us who kind of look and go, gee, I wonder what's happening. And like, right, and like you want to go and check it out. And it's like, you know, and I think if you're in the latter category, there's a much greater likelihood that you're going to grow up and be a writer or a storyteller or a journalist. It's just interesting because there's just so many things that happen in this world most people don't care about. And then there's a small group of people who just seem to care about it all.
I mean, that's so true, Andy. I actually had a childhood friend's father who used to call me Scoop. And at the time, it wasn't necessarily a compliment. I mean, he was saying I was nosy and I wanted to know what was happening in their household, in the neighborhood. I just always had a little bit of information, seeing that ambulance run by. Oh, yeah, that stopped at so-and-so's house. So I'd be the relayer of information. And you're right. I mean, you just latch on to the things that allow you to explore the world when you have that disposition.
So you found yourself in TV news. What was your first big break?
Yeah, so I was a senior in college and I needed a job. I was really broke. I w thought I was going into newspaper journalism. I was through and through a print major, but I was really broke and I saw this flyer, because this was back in the day, you know. So I saw this flyer for a teleprompter operator at a local news station. And I thought that could be a job that I could do. So I called them up and I got that job as a teleprompter operator and then an audio, the board. So I do the audio for the local news. And then I moved up from there to be a producer, morning show producer, then noon producer. And that's when I knew like I was in my element. Okay, I'm in the newsroom now. And so I was a producer for several years before then I transitioned to being a reporter. And I just love all of the components of production. So television production, audio production, even within print and newspapers, they're no longer the behemoth that they used to be. But even just the production of putting together, the layout of the newspaper and the front page and what and how it will all come together and how it will be presented to people. I've always been fascinated by the behind the scenes as well as the actual stories.
And when you were doing television reporting, did you ever get to a point where the fascination with the sirens and the, oh my God, I wonder what's happening, did it ever become like, oh Jesus, another one of those stories?
Yes. And I will tell you that moment happened for me around 2013, 2014. So, when you do this type of job, when you're a local television reporter, in a way it becomes muscle memory. Even though you're doing a new story every day, it's a certain format. It's a certain amount of time that's given to a story. And that was always a challenge for me. The last local television job that I had was in Seattle, Washington. And I will say that that was probably one of the best places to be for a local TV news because at the time they were still doing more expansive type stories. It wasn't just a 50-second or 2-minute piece. I could actually do maybe 5 minutes on a particular topic and go a little bit deeper and narrower on a story. Maybe it wasn't just like if it bleeds, it leads. I was going into some of the systemic issues, and that was exciting. But even within those that expansiveness, there were still these parameters that I had to work under. I also, at that moment and at that time period, it was just a heavy burden to face like the worst that was happening in our communities and in humanity day in and day out. And knowing that I felt in some way helpless, and being able to help the people that I was interacting with every day. So while I was fed by being able to share these stories, knowing these details, being a slight comfort for people, because I do love being with people and talking with people and letting them share their truth with me. I feel like there is a certain amount of agency given to people during their worst times when they can actually speak about what's happening to them. There was a heavy toll. I'll tell you if I have time to tell you this, that there was a particular story when I knew that I needed to take a step back. And it was a case involving a father who had murdered his two young children and then set the house on fire. And it happened on a Saturday. I wasn't working that day, but I received a call from a source who said, "Something really bad has, Tanya, has happened, and I think you should come out here." So I called my station and said, "Something's happening there. I'm going to drive there and meet me there." And when I arrived, my GPS sent me to the back of the house instead of the front of the house. And what I saw, I had just arrived as firefighters had put out the fire and they had discovered the bodies of the children. And there were these firefighters who were sobbing and holding each other. And it was such a heavy moment, and my heart was so heavy. And I spent the next 2 days covering that story. it had such a profound effect on me. I just felt like I needed to take a break in that moment. And yeah, that was when I decided to step away from local television news.
And so you did step away. And I think prior to 22, you co-hosted NPR and WBUR's midday talk show Here and Now. And then you landed Fresh Air. You co-host with Terry Gross. And so you went from 2-minute stories, basically, to long form interviews, which has to be not only just a totally different landscape for you, but a really gratifying one, because you have the opportunity now to talk to whoever you want for a pretty extended period of time and cover subjects that are so deeply personal to you. It's got to be an incredible journey that you're on right now and have been for the last few years.
Andy, it really is. And, you know, it took me some time to find my place in the medium and to deepen my understanding of what makes a great long-form interview. I'm still in that process, because with every person, it's different. Mm-hmm. You have to find that connective tissue while also finding the thread of the conversation and also the arc of the conversation. So I think that, you know, the best conversations are when you listen in and you feel like you're just listening to two people have a wonderful conversation. You're going to all these wonderful places and there's not a lot of forethought behind it. It's just naturally happening. That's when the conversation has really been crafted by the interviewer, and being very intentional on the questions I ask, when I ask, and also allowing the conversation to lead me at the same time. Terry Gross is a legend, of course, and she's done it for 50 years. And so it's almost muscle memory for her. I am in this position where I'm using my skills from my previous jobs to actually help me inform how I do the work. And it actually has been helpful that I have had these experiences where I've done short form interviews, because they also allow me to understand space and time and where and how I'm able to piece this all together. So it's been beautiful to also lean into my curiosities, because the other thing about being a journalist versus a host is that I am letting my curiosity lead as a journalist, as a reporter out in the field, but I'm also thinking about some of the bigger pictures, like what is the news of the day and how it corresponds with this story? What do listeners need to know and hear about? And of course, I'm thinking about that with my long form interviews, but I'm also following my own curiosities about the person. And that's been fun. And actually, it's taken me a while to get used to that and feel comfortable with letting a little bit of my own personality and interests shine through.
But because at the end of the day, it is all about you. It's I mean, you could talk to anyone, right? You can, somebody can stick a piece of paper in front of you and say, oh, here's 10 great guest ideas. But the guests have, the people, the individuals, what they do, who they are, has to resonate with you and who you are, so that you will be interested in engaging with this person for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 minutes. I can't imagine, because I go through the same thing, I can't imagine doing that with someone and a subject that doesn't...
That you're not into.
That you're not into. Now, that doesn't mean that the subjects aren't interesting and critically important. It also doesn't mean that the people aren't interesting. It just means that there's a bazillion people in this world. I can't talk to all of them. So who am I going to talk to?
It's so true.
Yeah, right? The process of selecting guests and then confirming them, how much fun is that for you?
It's everything. It's so much fun. It's the most exciting part of the job. And I will tell you, when I first started, though, a year ago, I thought that, you know, I was presented with people and I knew that certain people were really high profile or really interesting, or I knew the public would love to hear from them. And I thought, okay, I need to say yes to these people because they are important. But it was through watching Terry and understanding how she chooses guests that I was able to figure out that, oh yes, this is a big part of this for me. I need to step out of that journalistic bubble just for a second to be able to let my curiosity lead the people that I choose to talk to. And so that has been very gratifying because it makes the work fun through and through. Because the thing about a Fresh Air interview is the same with your show, is that a lot of research goes into it. I have to sit with this person for a whole week. Actually, that's the fun part. By the time we get to the interview, that's just the payoff to the fun that I've had all week of exploring their lives, reading their work, watching their work. So it is really gratifying to spend a week with a person that I'm really into and then finally have a conversation and have these questions and curiosities fulfilled during the conversation.
And how often do you get to talk with someone who, in a way, you almost don't need any prep for because they've been such a part of your life for so many years? Like, I recently interviewed Danny Bonaducci from the Partridge Family.
Oh, you did? Yes, yes.
And it was the most fun I've ever had in my life. I really didn't need much research. It's just like, I'm talking to Danny Bonaducci. And so those types of interviews for me are always the most fun because it's like somebody's been a part of who I am since I'm a kid. I interviewed Peter Frampton once. That was like the biggest thrill in my life. And so how many of those types of interviews do you do where someone is so important to you, you're such a fan or an admirer or someone who's inspired you in some way?
That happens all the time. And I'll give you an example of one that this was before the big incident, but I'll tell you Will Smith. I grew up with Will Smith. He had written a memoir, and of course I learned so much from his memoir, but I had followed his career. I had seen every single thing he'd been a part of.
Me
I followed
too.
His life. I knew. So that conversation, I really could have stepped in without having any notes. And he was present and there for the conversation. That is the fun part too. I know you feel that too. You know, when you have someone, so when all those things align, you know their work really well. They're ready to sit down and focus in on you and have that conversation. It's when magic is created.
Sure.
It's when you're able to get somewhere that maybe they've not been before and you've not been before. That's and you've not even thought about when you've been conceptualizing the interview. Those are really golden moments.
And that's the beauty of this format is that it's not like a two-minute hit on CNN or MSNBC or whatever. It's you're sitting down and having an in-depth conversation. You know, you go back in time. And a lot of times, you know, you can learn from those early years who the people became because there is connective tissue to what a nine-year-old may do and think and love to what they grow up doing. And those are great moments when together you understand how A plus B has equaled C in that person's life. So when you interviewed Will Smith, were you nervous?
I was nervous, I'll admit it. But he was so present and something really interesting. So a lot of our interviews for Fresh Air, we don't have visuals at all. And at the particular time that I was interviewing him, he was on his book tour. And so we had to do it by phone, by this special program that we do on the phone. And we kept having technical difficulties. He kept hearing himself and his feedback. But he said, I really want to do the interview, so I'm going to push through with this. And so for the entire hour and a half that we spoke, he was hearing feedback of himself. And I think that showed me something else, too, about the consummate professional that he is, that even in spite of all of these technical difficulties, he's going to ride it through as if nothing is happening. And for some reason, that really took away my nerves too, because I knew he was going through something internally in his head as with every bit of our conversation. And by the midway through, I wasn't nervous at all. It was like a friend just talking with someone. Yeah.
Man, I would love to hear you interview him now. Are you working on that?
I know, right? We need to make that happen. He's got a lot to talk about.
He certainly does. And it would be a good thing for him to do and a good place for him to do it. I mean, it's an unfortunate situation on every level. I remember watching The Fresh Prince first time I saw him, and I was like, who is this guy? He's going to be...
This is a star.
Huge,
yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it was undeniable, and I've loved everything he's done. And so there's a part of me that's a little sad because you never like to see somebody fall the way he's fallen and over something so stupid. I mean, look, you see things all the... Like, Jeffrey Toobin is back on CNN. I think
we're ready for Will Smith. We're going to go after
back.
It. You're right. He
go
needs to
it.
Come back and talk about it. Especially, you know, someone like him, he has been in the public eye most of his adult life and shared so much about his life that this is just the next step explaining this because having a deeper conversation for
Look, we're all infallible in some way. We've all made mistakes. We all have things in the closet that we're not proud of. And he's no different. And I think he should get out there and talk about it and explain himself and just ask for forgiveness from people, not just from Chris Rock, but from everybody. So Howard Stern always says he has a face for radio. Do you enjoy being off camera versus your days as a glamorous TV reporter?
Glamorous. That's funny.
Well, I wanted to make sure that you weren't going to say, is he saying I don't have a face for television? I wanted to
gotta
make
be
that
careful, cool.
Gotta
right?
be careful.
Yeah. You gotta be careful. I do like not having the pressure of having a face on. It's funny, just before I got on with you, I was like, can I just step on without any lipstick on? I don't know if this is gonna be recorded
what I do
or
every
not.
Interview.
Oh no, yeah, it's gonna there is such an intimacy to audio, and it's what I love about the medium. I also know that people are visual people. And like visual, we just love visuals, especially in the age of, you know, our cell phones where many of these podcasts we listen to. So I love the intimacy of not having to perform in that way that you have to when you're on camera. But I also see the value in it and imparting the message. And I think there's an intimacy to just being able to be as you are, you know?
I agree. I think we've become too visual. But what I have personally found is that I like going to sleep at night and putting on a podcast. I like I like walking and jogging, listening to a podcast. Yep. It's almost like we're going back a little bit in time to the old radio days. That's what podcasts feels like to me, is like when we used to just sit around and listen to a story, you know, and I'm going to talk about yours with you in a minute, you know, a docu-series where you can really get into the serialized nature of a story like people did back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. There's something really cool about that. So I do think there is an appeal to this medium that is really fascinating to me. Yeah, there is.
And there's a yearning to slow our brains down. And I actually just did an interview about overthinking. And we are all anxious overthinkers in this moment because we are so highly stimulated. And so yes, there's something really grounding to being able to listen. The oral tradition is something that humans have become accustomed to. We've evolved to understanding that as a mode of communication and storytelling since the beginning of time. And so being able to slow down and listen to each other and the intimacy of a voice is so powerful, sure.
And to concentrate, because you know, our attention spans are so different because of the phone now, the iPhone.
Yep.
And podcasts, especially, you know, a series, really require you to pay attention and slow down and just get out of the world that you live in that may be stressful and just sort of lose yourself for a while. I want to ask you about TV news. So going back to the 70s, there, you know, and I grew up in New York, so I was, you know, there were so many cool people of color and minorities on local news. And I think that was one of the strengths that local news networks always had, is that they were able to recognize early on the need for representation. But how has the industry changed, in your opinion, in terms of covering stories important to people of color and minorities?
Ooh, Andy, now that is a question. I mean, it's such an important one that I don't think that we've really explored in spaces where we're talking about diversity and inclusion and thinking about the ways that we represent communities. I have been reckoning with the ways, especially early in my career, I always try to fight against the way that local news covered crime and the overemphasis on certain communities and the underemphasis on what happens in other communities. And what I learned through my experience was that it wasn't necessarily that there weren't crimes happening in other communities that were maybe predominantly white communities. There were lots of different factors as to why we didn't know those things were happening. Many times police reports aren't filed, or they're private agencies that work to secure, you know, closed communities, and you would never, that would never make its way to local news to become a news story. The overemphasis on crime reporting and the way that we report it really has been a detriment to society, because it has formed the opinions of communities of color for people for decades because it's sensationalized, it's underreported, it's overreported in a sensational way. And so I grapple with that as I think back on my news career. And I think that while, as you put it, local news stations have been really great in trying to be representative of the communities they serve with their hires, I don't think the way that we have covered those communities gives us an expansiveness of those communities. And I think that it's really sad because local news is still such a powerful medium. In fact, it is the most expansive medium that can cover and it can, it has the most reach of any medium, mm-hmm. even you know, digital, because people have televisions. No matter where you are, they have televisions. I hope that local news can find a way to think of new ways to be able to cover with their as their budgets shrink and their staff shrink, they still provide a great service, but mm-hmm. they're not doing it now. I'll mm-hmm. just be straight up. It's not happening. Mm-hmm.
But co-hosting Fresh Air gives you an opportunity to delve deeper into the world that you grew up in, the world that is important to you from a cultural standpoint. And that must be really satisfying to be able to explore and really get into subjects that you feel elsewhere, to your point, are not being covered well.
Absolutely. And some of the things I'm thinking about are, what are the ways that we can make certain that all audiences have access to Fresh Air? Because public media, more generally, is a pretty white space. And, you know, that's for several different reasons. But I think that's why, as much as I love the audio, that it's just straight audio, it's radio. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the ways that Fresh Air can be in lots of other places so that lots of other types of people can also hear and listen to this type of programming. Mm-hmm.
So one last question on Fresh Air before I want to ask you about She Has a Name. Tell us something that we don't know about Terry Gross. Any great Terry Gross funny stories?
You know, I think that a lot of the things that you probably know about her are the most interesting, quirky things. I will say that she is very generous with her space and her time. She has been self-sacrificing to the show for 50 years. It's amazing. And when I say that, I say self-sacrificing, but really it is at the core of who she is. I think if you would see her life and you'd say, okay, almost every moment of her life has been dedicated to Fresh Air, but she wouldn't have it any other way. Mm. And so that was really interesting to see from the inside, because she's still just as dedicated and still just as in it as she's always been. I don't know if you've seen, we did an Instagram video where we were in her office and she showed what she eats in any given day. And she has all of these like freeze-dried meals and canned meals that she eats because she doesn't really want to take a lunch break. It's not that she can't, but she's so deep in the work that what is going to be fast and easy to eat. So I think that's the one thing maybe about Terry Gross that you should know, is that her palate is very unrefined and she will say it. She's mm-hmm. going to eat ramen noodles and just like, you know. Right.
Freeze-dried meals. We're breaking news here, folks.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's talk about your new 10-part audio docuseries. It's called She Has a Name. It's presented by Truth Be Told. And I want to read a little bit of a promotional blurb just to sort of set the table here. In 1987, a woman named Anita Wiley disappeared from her home in Detroit when her son Antonio was just 14. Her body wasn't recovered until 33 years later, when a first-of-its-kind DNA program matched Antonio's DNA with quote-unquote unknown woman 1987, his mother's remains that were buried in a mass grave for unidentified bodies just a few miles away from where Antonio grew up. Anita was one of nearly 700 people killed in Detroit that year at the height of the crack epidemic. But what happened to her, and why did it take more than 3 decades to find her body? This is truly an amazing story. I've been listening this week, but it's also a deeply personal one to you.
It's a deeply personal one because Anita was my sister, but she was a sister that I never got to know. And this experience of producing this 10-part podcast has been probably one of the, how can I put it? Like, it's been a life-changing experience for me because not only am I digging into the things that are the deepest wounds from my family, I'm also learning about a person that I really wish that I had grown up with, that I had known. And also I see myself in her just through what I'm learning about her from everyone else. It's also just been so gratifying, you know, as a journalist, we always say like storytelling can be healing. It's wonderful to give people a voice to allow them to tell their stories. And I did always believe that, but I can see in real time with my family members how important it is for them to be able to speak about something that for many of them, they haven't spoken about in 30 something years. There are people that we talk to who couldn't even really say my sister Anita's name without getting upset because it was a way for them to be able to cope is to not talk about it. Mm-hmm. So opening up these wounds, while it was pretty painful for many people, it has also been very gratifying for everyone on the project. I have an aunt who Anita and I shared who said, this made me realize I actually do have stories to tell about my own life, that there are things that I never thought were important to bring back up that I want to bring up for myself. That's real power. Mm-hmm. It's such power.
This series so resonates with me because, as you know, my late wife, Adrienne Shelley, she was murdered in 2006. Since then, I've been raising a daughter. She was not even 3 at the time. She's now 20. Like Antonio, she's grown up without a mother. And so I understand the journey that you are on to find out not just who this woman was, but what did she mean to the family? What does she mean to you? I made a documentary for HBO called Adrienne, which was exactly for the same reason. She's not just a murder victim. She's a human being, and I needed to humanize her. So listening to your first 2 episodes, I so get it. And listening to Antonio, it is heartbreaking to me when I listen to him speak.
I want to say to you, Andy, I know you're living with this every single day, and so I want to offer my condolences and also tell you that it's so powerful what you've done and what you continue to do. And I see so much of Antonio in you. I see you in Antonio, and like this ability, the strength of experiencing something so tragic and showing up every day, speaking every day, learning, growing. There's so much for Antonio. You know, his mother disappeared when he was 14 years old, and he does have very salient memories of her. As I mentioned in the podcast, though, his memories are as a child, and he's learning about his mother in real time as we produce this podcast, but he's also being able to see her in totality, in the mm-hmm. totality of who she was. But I am just so gratified that, and also honored that I've been given this opportunity to help him walk through to tell this story. I actually think it is it's the reason why we're connected. Of course, because we're family, but there is something very special that happened over the last mm-hmm. 20 years that has allowed me to be able to just step back and allow him this space to share something that has impacted so many people and so many people deal with. There are so many people who have family members who were murdered or went missing or who died in tragic ways. And having a space to be able to share is so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've also set out on this journey to literally find out what happened, because you didn't find out that you had a sister until what, 10 years after she went missing?
She disappeared, yeah.
And then you didn't find out what happened to her until 33 years later. I mean, the questions that you and your nephew and the family had to walk around with for all of those years, it's amazing that you're able to now start to answer those questions.
Yes. And, you know, the part of why I see so many parallels between your story and in you and your journey and Antonio is because even as a young man at 14 years old, he knew his mother. He knew his mother wouldn't just disappear. He knew that something was wrong. I know that in your case, you knew that what authorities were telling you about Adrian wasn't true, wasn't right, that something else had happened. And even through your grief, you were dogged in trying to figure out what that was and coming up with to bring justice to her. For Antonio, it took many years because he was a child. And so he didn't have that power and autonomy as an adult. But once he became an adult, he was very dogged in his quest to find out what happened, trying to get the FBI to take on the case, trying to get Detroit police to take it on. And it wasn't until he met this detective that was a dogged detective that said, I think I have an idea on how I'm going to try to move through these missing persons cases, that they were able to get closer to that. So yes, as you said, this podcast is also trying to figure out what happened to her, because although we know that she was murdered in a very brutal way, we still don't know who did it. But Antonio has theories, and many of his theories, authorities say, are on, they're on their radar. And so you know that it takes a dogged family members to move things forward. Police can only do so much, especially when they are overloaded with so many cases that they're dealing with. If you can also be that tenacious person who's like really pushing forward along with, in conjunction with police, it can be helpful in finding answers. And I hope we do during the course of this.
Well, the interesting thing to me about Antonio's overall arc is that, yes, he knew his mother because he was 14, but how much can a 14-year-old really know about your parent and what they do and who they are as a person? In fact, you know, there were things that he ended up learning about his mother that he concealed from you, you know, in this process, because he didn't want to poison your perceptions. But so for a 14-year-old, even though he had 12 more years than my daughter, and therefore he has visceral memories, it seems to me that he, at his stage in life now, is way older than his mother was then. Like, how that's flipped, you know. So your whole perspective of them changes. His perspective of his mother has to be flipping so interestingly for him, and in many ways heartbreakingly, as he learns about her as an adult while he's an adult.
This point you're making is so important, because it also speaks to why all of this could only happen now. So he had an idealized version of her in his mind. And when she was ripped away from him, you know, he held on to those memories and that one-dimensional view of her to move through life, to move through the world, because otherwise, how could you? I think when he was younger, facing some of those hard truths about his mother probably would have been really hard for him. It would have taken him out of what he needed to do and be at that time to be strong, just to move through life. And so for those who are listening, my sister Anita was also involved in drugs and was a drug dealer in Detroit at a time when drug dealers were vilified and drug users were also vilified during the 80s and the 90s. She was doing it as a means of survival, and there's so much, so many other details there that will bring understanding to why she was involved in that world. But Antonio learned this pretty early on, but he did not let me know that. And that another reason why he didn't let me know that is because he had this idealized version of his mother, he also felt like it might taint my view of her too. And maybe I wouldn't be as interested in her or her life or figuring out what happened to her, because society tells us these are not redeemable people who are involved in these types of things. And so part of this podcast is also reframing that idea that a certain person's life may not hold as much weight or importance because of what they were involved in. I think understanding why they were involved and what they were involved in is just as important in us understanding the human condition and what people go through.
You yourself have experienced and or witnessed so much violence and trauma throughout your life, drive-bys, friends getting murdered, your sister's death. You have such an interesting journey through loss and grief. How have you navigated through that so that it didn't end up breaking you?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, I don't know, Andy. I feel like I feel like maybe I could answer this a few different ways. I think my work helps me because I am constantly expressing. I'm not holding on to anything. I am expressing with those in my life that love me and I love, and with the public. I think when you've grown up the way that I've grown up, seeing things, you know, I was just remarking to someone that we were talking about childhood friends, and I realized one of the reasons why I only have one or two friends from childhood that I'm still in touch with is because many of the people that I was good friends with have died tragically and they're no longer here. And if I take myself back to that time and think about the fact that I've lost so many people, it is really hard. Therapy has also been helpful. Again, that's an ex being able to express, and a loving and supportive family. I also cry a lot, Andy. I don't know what
Me
you do and
too.
how you do,
I
but
still cry.
crying, yeah, crying is so therapeutic for me. It cleanses me, and sometimes I'll be going for a long, every night I go for walks. You know, I live in Los Angeles, and so I could do that. And there are many nights where I'm going for a walk and I just have on my sunglasses and I'm just crying, and it allows me to just get that all out and come back home and start anew. I also think I'm just purpose driven. Like, I do think that I have an important story to tell about people who aren't seen and who we'll never know about, but are important. And it helps us understand not only them, but ourselves and our place in the world and how the world works. And so I think in that way, that keeps me strong.
Do you cry more for Antonio than you do yourself? Because I know what I go through mourning for Sophie, for her loss. It's sort of like it's hard for me as a parent. It's a little different for you with, but you know, he's your nephew. But when a child is involved, and although Antonio is not a child anymore, he is a child that for much of his life has grown up without a mother. You find yourself mourning this loss of Anita more for him per se than for you.
Every day. Yeah. I don't think I've even come to grieving what her loss means to me. I did mention before, I wish I had grown up with her, but the seat of my mourning is for Antonio. And also, as you mentioned, how he's older now than she was when she was murdered. I think about how proud she would have been to see the man that he is. What an amazing man. It makes me emotional just thinking about it, that he has gone through all of these things in his life and he still shows up every single day. And he's the kindest person who loves his children and his feet, and just he's pouring into his children and he's pouring into the people that he loves every single day. And I think she would be amazingly proud because even in spite of all that she had gone through, he was her shining light. I learned that through everyone else, that everything she was doing was like for Antonio. So, and I mourn for everyone. I'm always mourning for those in the world. In many ways, we're all, I mean, not in any ways, I really do believe that we're all one, we're all connected. And so when I'm crying, I'm just crying for the state of being that we're all in these situations.
Do you believe in closure?
I believe that grieving and mourning is a forever thing that we are always going through. I don't think there's closure in the way that our simple minds think of it, like we can close a book and it's done. I think we can have mechanisms and tools. I think the tools that we have right now, where we're talking to each other and talking it out, that gets us a step closer to being able to just move through every day. And the same thing with this podcast with Antonio, it's allowed him to move through the day. But when there's a hole in your heart, there's no closing it.
No, I've struggled with that concept for my whole life, but in particular since Adrian died, like how do you have closure when you lose somebody? Is there a day where you wake up and you're like, that's it. I feel great. I don't miss him anymore. I don't know, it's I'm not mourning, I'm not sad. I'm able to move on. You know, I never understood how people believe in that so much, but whatever works for people is what I support, you know.
I do have a question for you. Do you, does it get easier? Does it feel further away? Or does it feel, are there days or moments where it feels so potent and fresh for you today?
Well, that's a really good question. And partly what I said before about, because I have a child who has gone through, like Antonio, so many milestones, you know, he's a smart kid. He went to college. Juanita wasn't there for that. You know, I don't know if he's married or has children of his own, but
yeah.
This is what gets me, because there's my own grief and mourning and sense of loss. And then there's that which I live through Sophie's life every day of her life. There isn't anything she does that I don't think is amazing where I don't stop and go, fuck, Adrian's not here to see it. And I'm going to do that till the day I die. And she's going to live that till the day she dies. And then that's when you're faced with the choice of, do I, you know, I'm a man, I'm not going to cry, or I don't cry, or am I just going to heave and haul and just let it out and then keep walking? And that's what I choose to do, the latter. I've never denied myself any pain, any grief, any crying. I just live my truth wherever it takes me, because I can't
imagine.
Have
you always been like that, or did you have to grow into being that way?
I think certainly Adrian's death changed the landscape a lot for me in that regard. But yeah, I was never the toxic male. Like, I am not going to cry. Like, I cried plenty in my life. And so I want to end with a question for you on something you said of your quest for answers about Anita's murder. You've said, quote, "Through this search, my nephew and I are discovering other things about ourselves and each other." What are some of the most meaningful things you've learned from this process?
You know, one of the big things is that I grew up raised by my mother and my mother's side of the family, and I never really got to know my father. And Anita and I shared the same father. Through this process, I've interviewed many family members on my father's side. I've learned so much about Anita. And through learning about Anita, I've learned about myself. It's me. I see the reflection of me. I'm learning so many things about me that didn't make sense, that I couldn't see on my mother's side. I see on my father's side. I see through learning about Anita. And it also, like, makes me realize I can't say with definity that, like, I wouldn't make the choices that she made in her life, which were many of them mistakes. I think that that is a powerful thing to experience and know about oneself, because I think we can all be sort of on a high horse of, like, I would never do this, or I can't ever see myself in this situation. And I could see myself in many of the situations she was in based on what she had gone through during her short life. Yeah, I would say that those are the things, but I would also say that I want to figure out a way that I could democratize and open up spaces for people to share their truth, their grief, and their joy in ways that, like, maybe we haven't conceived of yet. Like, we have all of these spaces and mediums and ways for people to tell their truths and emote. And yet still, people don't really have these safe spaces where they can feel like their voices are heard. It's just really, you know, we have more choice than ever before, and yet it doesn't seem like it. And so I'm just thinking through, what are the ways that I can open this up for other people and other families? You know, I will say that the podcast, there is a moment towards the end of the season where we visit the cemetery where Anita's body had been for almost 30 years as an anonymous person. And they're still digging up those bodies, and there are all these red markers. If you go there, it's an astounding thing to see all of these anonymous graves. There are dozens and dozens of families who are still searching, and they don't even know that their loved one is buried.
Right.
That's a massive undertaking, and it's not just in the city of Detroit. This is in every major city in the United States. They have these grave sites. I want to find a way for people to find connection and start that process of healing by identifying their loved ones. I think that's so important. So those are the things I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really beautiful thought, and you're doing it by example, you know, at this point. And I'm sure you will achieve that goal. I have no doubt. I lied before. I do have another question. It's a window into the soul question. So we like to try to find out who people really are, and sometimes the best way to do that is through music. So
okay.
Give me Tanya Mosley's top five musical artists of all time.
Oh, okay. So, you know, I am a Detroit baby, and even though that was a long time ago, I'm still a Motown person. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Marvin Gaye is like the pinnacle for me. Stevie Wonder, mm-hmm. Aretha Franklin, all of those people. But more modern day, I love Raphael Sadiq, Tony. He has created some of the greatest songs of all time. You know, he's been songwriter on so many songs that you just wouldn't even know that he wrote, but he did. And he's a prolific musician and artist. I love Billy Joel. I'm trying to get Billy Joel on the show.
He is on his last tour.
I know, right? He's going on his last tour. This is supposed to be it. Mm-hmm. I know. He's one of the most amazing writers of all times. Mm-hmm. And the songwriting, I mean, when I was a little girl, I'd be there, as I told you, on my brother typewriter, and Billy Joel would be playing in the background. Mm-hmm. You know, I love Billy Joel. I'm very much into yacht rock of the 80s, mm-hmm. 70s and 80s. So Michael McDonald, like the Doobie Brothers, like I do have an old soul in that way. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get into new music. I have a 17-year-old daughter and she introduces me to a lot of new music. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying not to be that old person who's like, oh, I hear the influence. You know, that is Motown, mm-hmm. or that is, mm-hmm. you know. but yeah, those are my artists. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great artists. Tanya, this has been such a thrill for me to talk with you. It's such a joy to talk with you. I literally have a ton more questions that I could be asking you, which means you'll have to come back and talk to me again and continue the conversation sometime.
Well, Andy, I really appreciate you having me on your show. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for your amazing work and your bravery. And it's just been an honor.
Good luck with the podcast. I can't wait to
listen to
the rest of it. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This episode of The Back Room was edited and produced by me, Andy Ostroy. It was co-edited and co-produced by Maddie Rosenberg and co-produced by Jen Hamoud. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Hollander, and our logo was designed by Cricket Langell. And special thanks to Patricia Wind. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast and also follow or subscribe. Until next time, keep your eyes on Washington, Hollywood, and your own backyards, and have a great week.